Good evening, everyone. Welcome to part 10 in our continuing saga of Shmuel Aleph, the wonderful book of Samuel. So last week we had the coming of age, publicly, of Shmuel HaNavi, of Samuel the prophet. We know that preceding this amazing moment, he was still Naaman. He was considered world-renowned within the Jewish people. His words did not fall to the ground. All his words were fulfilled by God. But in our liturgy we say, Moshe ve'Aaron b'Kohanav, that we have Moses and his brother Aaron and the Kohuna, the priesthood, on one hand, Ushmuel b'Koreshmo, and they compare them to Samuel. So this is the moment that Samuel becomes, in some ways, the equal of the great sons of Amram, Moshe and Aharon. How so? He brought the nation together to mitzvah, we said. And they davened, they poured out their hearts, they repented for their crimes of idolatry, they removed the idolatry from their hearts, and they were ready to be God's chosen people again. The Philistines misinterpreted the point of their gathering. They thought, oh, those Jews are getting together, conspiracy theories proliferated on the internet, and the Philistine officers gathered together to make war. We, the Jewish people, of course, are discombobulated at even the thought of trying to fight. We left all our weapons back on the farm, so what are we going to do? Samuel says, fear not. Offers up an offering. He asks God, please help me out here. God thunders down literally upon the Philistines a directed thunderstorm which absolutely blows them away. Orally, they can't hear, they can't talk. The whole game plan went out the window, kind of like we said with the Mike Tyson first punch. Remember? That first punch landed and the Philistines are like looking for the ropes and counting. They're getting counted out. And at that point, we left off. Verse number 13, Yud Gimel of Perek Zion, the seventh chapter. Vayikanu aflishtim velo yasfu od. And so the Philistines were humbled, and they no longer came in. Lavo bigvul Yisrael. They never were a threat. They never entered into the boundaries, the borders of the Israelites ever again, as long as Samuel was the leader. But tehi yad Hashem v'plishtim, and the hand of God was very strong among the Philistines, kol yemei Shmuel, all the days of the life of Samuel. Unfortunately, Samuel only lives 52 years, so it's an abbreviated life, but for the entirety of his life, Samuel's there to direct the people, to judge the people. Everything is good. The plishtim, who we said 2 weeks ago at our last class, were a world power. They came from some little islands off of Greece. They were not the local Canaanites, who were a bunch of backwater good old boys. No. These Philistines were a world power. The first time we've ever had an interaction with them since we left Egypt, which was the world power at that time. So it's significant. And then it goes on to tell us that the return of the cities in Yud-Dalet in number 14, Vatoshavna ha'arim, and they returned all the cities, asher lachu v'shtim, that the Philistines had taken away me'es Yisrael, from the Israelites earlier, Le Yisrael, they were returned to the Jews, to Israelites. Me Ekron, from the city of Ekron, Va'ad Gaz, to the city of Gat, Vet Gvulan, and their border areas, all the areas around them, the little cities and villages. Hitzil Yisrael miyad plishtim. The Jewish people, the Israelites, were able to rescue and redeem them from the hand of the Philistines. Vayi Shalom, and there was even peace, Bein Yisrael uvein Ha'amori, between the Amorite nation of the Canaanites, who apparently had some tsuras, some political and military problems with the Jewish people. But when the Amorites got wind of this directed storm and the Philistine devastation, they immediately held up their white flags. We're suing for peace too, right? Sort of like, you know, sort of like the Italians in World War II, right? You know, they didn't get directly attacked, but when they heard that things weren't going well, they rallied, you know, they all, Mussolini and the guys, held up their white flags. They weren't even being attacked. They said, count us in. We're suing for peace, okay? So the Amorites, they sued for peace. They had the white flags up. Vayishpot Shmuel es Yisrael, and Samuel judged the nation of Israel, kol yemei chayav, all the days of his life. Very short, succinct pasuk, but it can't be true. Because he didn't really start judging the people until after the death of, at least, Eli, his teacher. Eli was the judge. So even if you want to say that maybe he worked in partnership with Eli, well, all the days of his life, we're talking from his childhood, I mean, his youth. Well, I mean, what are we talking about? So the rabbis here extrapolate and say, no. When a person is dedicated, the way Samuel was dedicated, his mother literally prayed for him to become this. The vision began in the womb. So from the womb to the tomb, I don't know why I'm rhyming like this, but from the womb to the tomb, maybe I had another job as a rapper, as a Jewish rapper, in another life. Well, Matisyahu, look out, right? From the womb to the tomb, Samuel was dedicated entirely to God. He was a Nazirite, right? And he lived and sacrificed, gave up really his own life for the people. And therefore, God elevates his life, that even those formative years where he ostensibly was not hands-on judging, he's given credit at the end of the life that all the life was there. It's a very powerful idea that when we dedicate ourselves to things bigger than ourselves, God elevates our status. And even those preparatory years, the years where we're learning our trade or whatever that might be, to get to the status where you've evolved to become a sensitive human being capable of great things, God says, I'm going to credit all the years from your childhood all the way forward, because you didn't just you weren't created in a vacuum. It didn't just happen a regalachat on one leg. It happened through a development. So he goes back retroactively and credits all those years, the formative years, as part of the equation. Tragically, of course, it would work the opposite way also. When someone, you know, devolves to the dark side, all those years that are credited, sorry, little Star Wars, we were talking off the record, God unfortunately sort of strips you of your goodness, not only for the days that you actually were away from. I mean, Philip and I were talking about the tragic case of Elisha ben Avuya. So he really lost. It sort of delegitimized not only his learning at the end when he became a heretic of such, it delegitimized all his teaching going backwards. You had this tragic, tragic Talmudic figure of amazing renown, Elisha ben Avuya, who was the teacher of the great Rabbi Meir, maybe the singularly brightest man in the world. Elisha became his teacher. And even after he became a little bit of a Acher, another individual, as he was known, a heretic, Rabbi Meir continued to learn from this individual. But it delegitimizes the past. And if you think about it for a moment, on a personal level, it makes a whole lot of sense, doesn't it? I mean, think about it. Let's say, God forbid, a person falls from grace. I'll talk about the comedian from Temple without mentioning his name tonight. It gives you an unclean feeling. You're thinking back to your youth when you enjoyed the cartoons and Fat Albert and all the things that we took such pleasure from. It almost delegitimizes and strips away all those joy, all the joy and joyful moments, right? Because of what you found out at the end strips away and invalidates the beginning, right? That's the negative. But on the flip side of the equation, we're saying that when a person rises to greatness the way Samuel did, we go back retroactively to those early days, and they're thrown in the equation in a positive way. So we see very clearly in our world, in reality, that the fall from grace can, unfortunately, in certain cases, be so pernicious and so horrible that it can strip away the past, like it did with Elisha ben Avuya and the man from Temple, or it can validate the past based on what your performance is in the future. People say, oh my gosh, look at this guy. How did this young man or young woman become such a great star? Must be. And they look back on your parents and your grandparents, and it impacts positively going back. God gives credit to everybody who created you genetically. So it's a very empowering idea, beautiful idea of Yizkor, right? That's what Yizkor is all about, that we're crediting the Bobbies and the Zadies going all the way back for who we are today, right? It's a very powerful and empowering type of idea. Okay. Let's go weiter, let's go on. So, the halach, Samuel used to travel, midei shana b'shana, year in and year out, from every year, the sabav, like sevivon, like the dreidel, going around in circles, he would go around in circles, he would circle from Beit El, from a place called Beit El, which the rabbi says probably Shiloh, where the tabernacle was located for like some 300 plus years. The HaGilgal, which was the first location of the tabernacle when they crossed over the Jordan with Joshua. The HaMitzvah, and that scene of the great victory over the Philistines with the lightning show from God. The Shabbat et Israel, and he judged the Jewish people. Eight Kolomakamadela, and all of these places he would travel. He had a little circuit. We pointed out months back that he was like the first circuit court judge. This is the creation of the idea of bringing the justice to the people. In other words, if you limit your justice, well, I'm going to stay here in Washington. Everybody's got to come to me. Even the premise is a little off-putting, that you are holding yourself above the people. You're not really in touch with the people, so maybe your judgment might be lacking because you're not really connected. Unfortunately, we see this with the judges and the politicians of our year, right? They're kind of disconnected from the reality of what happens in the rest of America. So that was what Shmuel, Samuel, did not want to happen. So he deliberately went out of his way. He had a Winnebago, and he basically traveled around from these little circuits, and anyone who needed justice for all, they come to Samuel, he comes to them. And then he would go back home. Pasuk Yud Zayin, number 17, to end the parak, to end the chapter. And then he would go back to Ramah because there was his home. Well, we know his home was in Ramah. We'll talk about that in a moment. Visham Shavad Yisrael. And he would also judge the Jewish people in his homeland, in Ramah. Vayiven Sham Yisbeach Lashem. And there he built an altar to God, which is going to have a very important part to play in Saul's life coming up in a chapter or so going forward. So what's the point here? When he had a home, he didn't really have a home. He refused to take one penny from anybody. Just the appearance of impropriety. And so he, we are told, as all judges should be, was wealthy. You want to be wealthy as a judge because then you become almost inscrutable, right? Nobody can, you know, come in with the Don Corleone can't come with a big black suitcase and put it down in front of you. You know, my nephew, he's got a little bit off the path, but judge, I'm sure you'll find it in your heart, right? And you don't know whether in that black case is a 357 Magnum or $300,000 in currency, right? But he's making an offer you can't refuse. You can't do that to Samuel because he had the big bucks. He had the Cayman Island account himself. He didn't take hospitality because what if there were strings attached? What if somebody would say, well, wait a minute, Samuel, you ate by us. You stayed by us. I supported you. You know, now I'm here as a litigant. What say you? No, he refused. He was beyond that. Yes, Mr. Roth.
How did Samuel earn his fortune?
Excellent. I think he had good stock portfolios. Yeah. Apple. Going back to Adam and Eve, you know.
Abacus.
The apple. Abacus stock. That's not so clear. I believe his family, perhaps there was a little bit of a Yerusha. There was an inheritance. You're making a good point. He never left, essentially, service of God.
Right.
So where exactly did he make the millions? Elkanah, his father, and his mom ostensibly had some money, and he must have been wealthy through, you know, good stock manipulation. Maybe God helped him a little bit, gave him a little inside lottery numbers, you know, coming up, Powerball numbers, and he had some money.
What about spoils for war?
Interesting. We would take spoils, the soldiers would, but he, as Samuel, okay, would not have participated, so he wouldn't have been in line for that. So excellent question. Very good. Thanks, Jeff. Perchas, verse 8. Let's think back for a moment. Do you recall that Samuel gets his first communique way, way back from God? And he thinks it's Eli, his master, calling him. Three separate times, God perhaps communicates with Samuel in the voice of Eli. So he keeps coming to Eli, saying, here I am, master. You called me, right? And each time he says, go back to home. Go back to sleep, go back, lie down. And he says, then third time, he says, you know what, God's trying to talk to you. So next time this voice comes, it's not me, Eli says, say, listen, please, God, because your servant is paying attention. I'm listening. Go. Right? What did God tell him? Remember the horrific prophecy. His first Nevi'ut was the downfall and destruction of his beloved Eli, his Rebbe, his teacher's whole house. Remember? What did Eli say? Remember he warned him? He said, don't withhold this from me. Now, we said at the point of the conversation the next morning between Eli and Samuel, Shmuel didn't know that his own dad, his own father Elkanah, had already prior to this moment come with the prophecy from God, the prophecy of doom. So in other words, Eli already knew this was just sort of doubling down, and Samuel didn't want to break the heart of Eli. So, and Eli was aware of it, that he was reticent. So remember, he said to him, if you withhold anything, so shall God do to your sons like he did. You should have sons like me, Hophni and Phinehas. Remember that? We said that you have to be really careful because when a tzaddik, when a righteous person, everyone here be careful. Don't utter a promise in vain, because even the impropriety of what could happen, even if it doesn't happen, the fact that you articulate the words out loud, they're kind of like hanging there, and they will become actualized in some way, shape, or form. How do we see this? You'll see this tonight. Because even though Eli said, your son should become like my son, you should only know, Samuel, if you withhold information, the pain of a father who has sons that have gone off the derech in a major way, that are off the path. Well, did Samuel withhold information? No, he told everything over to Eli. Even so, the fact that he sort of articulated a conditional curse, his sons, as we'll see now in chapter 8, Perechas, they weren't so good. Now, they weren't nightmarish, like Hophni and Pinchas were, but you'll see in a very unusual way, there is a little bit of a commonality that the sons of Samuel and the sons of Eli share, perhaps owing to Eli's misuse of words. Words matter. Words are speech. God created the world with speech. He could destroy a world with speech. We know our world by humans can be destroyed through talking, through lashon hara, through bad language. So it's important. Parakas, chapter 8. Vayihina was, kasher zaken Shmuel, that when Samuel became old. Stop for 1 second. But he died at 52. So we're talking now a premature aging. He didn't become feeble. He wasn't like old in a conventional way. He was young. He wasn't even middle-aged by today's standards. He was like 48, 49, whatever. He was a young guy. But prematurely he aged. So he could no longer get in the Winnebago and travel to those cities. So he would basically stay home, and he handed off the court to who? To his sons. So what happened? Vayosem es banav shoftim Israel. So he appointed his sons to be the new judges for the Jewish people, for Israel. Vayehi, and it was, Shem beno habachor Yoel, his oldest son, the firstborn was Yoel, the Shem Mishneu, and the name of his second son was Avio. Shoftim be'er Sheva. They were judges in the city of Beersheba. Stop. Beersheba, beautiful city in the desert city of Israel, correct? And right above the Negev. Beersheba, place that Abraham created when he made a covenant with Abimelech. Well, that one sentence, though, tells us the qualitative difference between the sons, Joel, and Avi, and their dad. Why? Because they had a base of operations, correct? Samuel never really had a base of operations. He traveled. The sons did not. They built an edifice. They built a courthouse. They had sponsorship for the courthouse. They had scribes to write down. They had people on the who were making money out of the justice system, right? You had lawyers, both sides of the equation. You had a whole judicial infrastructure that was placed in Beersheba, and the sons didn't go. So let's look at the next verse. This is both to be taken interestingly in a literal and a metaphorical way. Verse Gimel, Pasuk 3. V'lo hachuvanav bidrakav. His sons did not travel in his ways. I mean, literally, right? Because they didn't leave home. They never went away from Beersheba. So it's both literal and metaphorical, right? They didn't travel in his ways, meaning in terms of integrity and honesty, but in terms of literally getting up and bringing justice to all. The circuit court stopped. No more travels for his sons. And now it gets a little bit scary. Vayitu acharei habatza. Not only did they not go and follow in his ways, they were swayed by profit. Oh my gosh. That's like shochad. We're talking about making money, right? Vayichush shochad. They took bribes. Vayatu mishpat. They perverted justice. Oh my gosh. By the way, the book was written by their father, Shmuel. What if I told you that they didn't do anything wrong? No perversion of justice, no acceptance of the black suitcase from Don Corleone, nothing. Do you remember, going back again to Hophni and Pinchas, that's the parallel, that they equated that Hophni and Pinchas delay the power that they had over those women who were married, who were waiting for their offerings to be brought, and they had to camp out all night, as if they had slept with the women in a carnal way. Do you remember? And the Torah actually recorded it that way, but we said that it can't be. It's not real in that way. It was as if, because they exerted that force. Same thing here. They did not, God forbid, accept actual bribes to pervert justice. But what did they do? They stayed put in Beersheba. They gave money to their friends, the cronies. They didn't take money. But you had an infrastructure. So you had a ton of jobs now that were reliant on there being the justice in Beersheba. Meaning everybody is coming. So you have a whole industry. You have the hotel industry, like the bed and breakfast, right? And you have the actual people working in the court, the stenographers and the lawyers and everybody else that goes into a court system. So they were the ones who profited. Their friends profited. But when you're on the level of a son of Samuel, no. Samuel wrote about his own sons, that they took bribes. because Ki'ilu, in the same way with Hophni and Pinchas, on their level of righteousness, where they should have been as sons of Eli the Kohen, they should not have delayed the women, so therefore we almost like elevate them negatively as if they did a horrific crime. The same thing is true here. In other words, the rabbis understand that Joel and Aviah did not, God forbid, accept bribes. But because they didn't travel with justice, they denied justice to the masses. Because they had an infrastructure that was status quo, where everybody had to come to them, and there was an industry, and they made money. Not them personally, but their friends made money, or their co-workers made money off of it. The Torah, or at least Samuel, their father, when he ascribes pain and suffering, he credits them in a negative way with having actually accepted and corrupted justice and bribes. So we see again, when you're closer to God, be on the lookout, because there's higher expectations. Now you can draw a parallel here. Who can I draw a parallel for you in today's modern age? How about Israel? For better or worse, the nations of the world, they understand that we're the Orla Goyim. We're supposed to be a light unto the nations. So when horrific things are done by Jews, whether they be in America, whether they be done in Israel, and thank God it happens so seldomly compared to the rest of the world, but when it happens, it crushes us emotionally. We feel devastated by it. You know, the video that circulated a couple of weeks ago at that wedding in Israel, it's horrific. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's heartbreaking. But it's not indicative of who we are. And therefore, I heard about this book by Ron Dermer, right? This book that the UN ambassador, Philip was telling me about this fantastic book about the UN. Well, the UN, you know, in its history, only sanctions Israel. I remember reading statistically about the number of like how many times they've sanctioned or dealt with Israel directly. It is so disproportionate. It's insane. It's insane, right? You ask, well, 250,000 Arabs have lost their lives directly as a result of Bashar Assad, right, in Syria. How many Arab League condemnations? Zero. How many UN Security Council condemnate? Nothing. Zero. World doesn't care. But when, you know, a bank Leumi in part of Jerusalem, when they, like, you know, break open a wall and extend 24 feet out to that area, oh my gosh, it's a war crime. We got to get together in the Security Council, right? I mean, it's really true. So, but getting back to this then, we as Jews have a higher calling ever since Abraham and Sarah, for better or worse. When we mess up, the world lets us know that we mess up. So when the sons of Samuel, or the sons of Hophni, the sons of Eli, when they mess up, it's here. Even though it's not really the reality of what they did, but it's there to see. God says, you want to descend from the genetics of Abraham and Sarah, you got a lot. You got a lot of responsibility, my friend. And it's very tough on us. It's very hard. It's not fair, but then again, it is. It's not easy being a Jew, right? As I say in Yiddish, it's very tough to be a Jew. Let's carry on. Parakas, chapter 8. So, as a result of justice not coming to the people, as a result of Samuel's sons Yoel and Aviah dropping the ball and not carrying on the wonderful tradition of their dad, the next part of the chapter makes a whole lot of sense. You know what the next part of the chapter is? The request Jewish people are going to make for a new leader, a melech, a king over Israel. And that's a direct result of the, shall we say, inefficiency and downright absolute, you know, abandonment of all the wonderful things that Samuel had built, that the sons don't go on that way. So what happened? Verse number 4, Pasuk Dalet in Parakas. Vayiskapsu kol zikne Yisrael. So all the elders, the rabbis, those rabbis, gather together. Vayavo el Shmuel haramaso. And they came up to Samuel, who was back home now in Ramah. Remember, that was his hometown. And because he's aged, he couldn't travel anymore. So he's back home. The idea that they would even get together and think that they could approach him with such bad news is a sign of Samuel's greatness, that he was a man of humility and accessibility to the people. Because you'll see in a moment, you can't imagine them coming to a king and saying what they're going to say about the guy's sons. Or the king would probably turn around to his guards and say, you know, off with these idiots' heads. Next, right? Okay, so let's see what they're going to say. Vayomru elav. And these elders, the rabbis, say to Samuel, to Shmuel HaNavi, Hinei ata zakanta. Oh my gosh, it's insulting. Behold, you have become old. That's not nice to say to somebody, even if it's true. Uvanecha, and your sons, lo hachu bidrachach, they haven't followed in your path. Ata, now, shima lanu melech. Please appoint for us, over us, a king, leshoftenu, to judge us, kechol hagoyim. Just like all the other nations of the world have a king, we want a king too. I remember as a kid, my father, Zichron Racha, was a man of tremendous integrity. And I remember vividly, if we ever, one of the kids came to him, and he'd say, okay, why do you need this? Well, all my friends at school have this. It was over. At the point where I prefaced my comment by saying, well, Johnny and Susie and Billy have one, my dad would just look and say, that's not a reason for you to have one. Sorry. Right? I mean, it's over. We all smile because probably our own parents had some of that same old school, old world type of sensibilities. So they're saying to Samuel, you're old. You can't do what you used to do. You don't get out on the road anymore. The road trips are off. You're not circuiting anymore around Israel. Your sons are clearly embedded and ensconced in their Beersheba home. We need a king now to judge us. Now, if you're Samuel, this is a huge insult. Forget about the fact that they call you old. Okay? Yeah, go retire to Florida, essentially, Samuel. Not nice, right? But the idea that they're saying, we want someone not to lead us, but to judge us. Samuel could have said, but I'm still alive. You know, as far as I know, my blood pressure and, you know, I'm still healthy. I'm with you. That's a huge insult. It's shtuch. You know, you go to the current rabbi and say, Rabbi, we need someone to teach us Torah. Okay, fine. You know, I'm a little older, but come on. That's a huge insult. What about me? What am I? Right? Am I chopped liver here? What's going on? Right? But the people apparently felt comfortable enough with Shmuel that he wasn't Mr. Hubris, that they could approach him, and that he wouldn't sort of metaphorically rip their heads off for having the audacity, the chutzpah to even ask this. Vayera davar b'enei Shmuel. So the matter was very displeasing. It was bad in the eyes of Samuel. Kasher amru, when they said, to Nalan and Melech Shoftenu, please give us a king to judge us. Obviously, we understand now. It's hurtful to him. So he reaches out to God. And he prays to God. He says, what do I do? These people are requesting a king. Vayomer. Turn the page. Vayomer Hashem El Shmuel. So God says to Shmuel, don't get so bent out of shape. Shma b'kol ha'am. Listen to the voice of the people. He's not telling him to say yes or no. He's saying, listen to their voice, meaning, how are they asking? What is the mindset here? What is the motivation here? L'chol asher yomro elecha, to everything that they're saying to you. Listen very carefully, Shmuel, and learn. Ki lo oscha ma'asu. They've not rejected. They're not disgusted by you, Shmuel, by Samuel. No. Ki osi ma'asu min l'chalem. I'm the king, God says. I'm the one who's taking care of them, the bunch of ingrates. I'm the one who's insulted. So if anybody's nose, metaphorically, should be out of joint, it's me, God says. Shmuel, just take a back seat. I'm the king. Now, what's going on here? There are three mitzvot, there are three laws that the Jewish people, when they become Israelites, living in the land of Israel, have to do. Number one, become like everyone else. Have a king. Fight Amalek. Build a temple. So this is stage one. It's not inappropriate at all. It's right there in the Torah. First, king, war with the Amalekites, which is exactly what happened after they get a king. Failed war. So Amalekite battle, build the temple in that order. So what's inappropriate? What's inappropriate, perhaps, some of the ideas that the rabbis throw out. Why do they need one? Well, we want to be like the Goyim. We want to be like everyone else. The nations of the world all have kings. So we want to copy them. It was a rejection of God. Because think about it. What was wrong with having Samuel at the helm? He's a pretty impressive man. Everything he says, true. You know, you ask him about next week's NFL playoffs, he'll tell you the final scores. Perfect, you know? You'll be in Vegas betting your money, you'll win. So he's a good man. He knows his stuff. So what's wrong with having him as a judge? You know what was the problem? It required the Jewish people to behave. Think about it for a moment. The failure of the Jewish people when they lost the Ark, it was not a failure of God. It was not a failure necessarily of leadership. It was a failure of the people, right? Because instead of introspection, saying, what's wrong with me? Why did I lose this battle? They said, oh, we need a God to come out, right? We need a miracle. We need some of that old-time religion. So that's what they were after. Okay. By the way, the coffee's getting me excited, so I'm just in case you see some, you know, it's not Starbucks, but it's Dr. Bell's, even better than Starbucks. So if I'm getting some energy, I'd like your part of the thing. Where's Kaplan getting this energy from? So it's the coffee. It's the coffee. Plus, I love this text, as you can see. So next, God says, okay, look, it's okay to ask for a king, but they're asking for a king because they're scared to live with me as their king, because I come with strings attached. I, God says, will take care of them and perform wonders and miracles. Look what I did to the Plishtim, the Palestinians, who were real Palestinians, the Plishtim, when I blew them away with my thunderstorm. I'm capable of miracles. But there's a caveat. When do you get a miracle? When you're deserving of a miracle. So the people didn't want that. So you know what one of the rabbis says they really wanted? Idolatry. So they wanted a king to kind of emulate the idol worship of all the other nations of the world. And if we have a king in front of us, not God the king, then yeah, I don't have to be so religious anymore, right? Come on, I won't go to so many classes, go to shul. I'm tired of that stuff. I don't want to have to be a goody two-shoes. If I have a king, I don't have to. I'll opt out. I'll be like everybody else. I don't need to be holier than thou. So that was the rejection of God himself, in other words. Because like we said earlier, when you're in God's proximity, it's a higher calling. It's like hypernational, right? I mean, you have got to be on your game or you're dead. Remember the double-edged sword? We spoke about the sons of the great people. You don't emulate and follow in the tradition of your parents. Boom, I'm going to write horrific things about what you didn't even do. Same thing with the Jewish people. When the Jewish people are close to God, there's laser proximity of being close to God. So you got to be careful. You got to be on your best behavior. The people said, no, I don't want this. Not for me. I don't want to be run by miracles anymore. I don't want to have to be doing teshuvah, repenting, Yom Kippur is enough once a year. I don't need it all the time. I want a king so I can go worship idols. That's not good. So God took it as a personal insult. He said, Samuel, me, I am the one they've insulted and rejected this day. Let's go fight you. On. Now it's going to get a little interesting. So what happens? What happens is the following. God says to Samuel, a little history now, Mr. Shmuel HaNavi, Ches, number 8. K'chol ha'masim asher asu miyom ha'losi yizlami Mitzrayim v'yarem hazeh, v'yazvuni v'yavdu Elohim achirim, kein hem ha'osim gam lach. He says, like all the deeds, like all the masim they have done from the day I brought them out of the Exodus from Egypt unto this day, God says, they forsook me, they worship gods of other peoples, they did idolatry, and they're doing this as well to you now. Nothing new. This is going back to the moment they crossed through the Red Sea. They had pockets filled with gold that they were going to make a golden image of, the golden calf, right? They were full of gold, but they also had pesel micha. They had that idol in their pockets as they're crossing the Red Sea. So this is not a new issue, Samuel. So just relax. And now, what did he say to him? V'atah, Pasuk Tes, number 9. Shema b'kolam. Samuel, listen to them. Heed their voice. Acquiesce to their request. Ach, only. Kaviat emtor. Let the buyers beware. Ki ha'ed ta'id bahem. You should surely warn them. V'higadat alehem. And tell them. Mishpat HaMelech, the laws of a king. What a king means for you. Asher Yimloch Aleihem, that will rule over them. Meaning, they want a king, it comes at a price. Stop for a second. So what's going on with Samuel and the judges? If you think about it, it was either opt-in or opt-out. If they liked the judge, if they respected the judge like they did with Shmuel HaNavi, everything's great. But if there was sort of a feeling, well, the judge, yeah, we can do better, I choose not to follow the judge. So you opt in, you opt out. You get a charismatic, wonderful leader. It almost becomes, I hate to use the word cult, but it almost becomes like a cult of personality, where depending on the charisma and the leadership abilities of your current judge, that's whether or not you're going to follow him. Now, with a king, there's no issue there, because it's the king, and then it's the king's son, and then it's the king's grandson, and there's no cult of personality. Now, as often happens, when things are passed from father to son to grandson to great-grandson, things go really well with the father. Less so when it comes to the son. Even less so when it comes to the grandson. So when you look back, for example, at great dynasties of old Europe and places, okay? The Rebbe, meaning the one who was like the formative guy from the whatever the whether it was a Hasidic dynasty, whether it was a Litvish dynasty, a Shiva dynasty, usually the one who started the institution or the movement was fantastic. They were like the best. But then when their progeny took over, usually there's like a little bit of a, you know, something less. He doesn't measure up to dad, right? By the time you get to the grandchildren or great-grandchildren, more often than not, what's the phenomenon? They're usually not at all. And there are people are saying, why am I still following this guy? You know, I went to that yeshiva when so-and-so was alive. The Rosh Yeshiva, that great yeshiva, was so-and-so, and he was the best. But now, like, three generations removed, his great-grandson's running the show. Oh, my gosh. He is so not like his great Zaidi, right? So why am I part of this? So that's the problem here, right? Eli's wonderful. Samuel, they're fantastic. You go one generation, it's a disaster. You don't have to even go to the grandchildren. So they didn't want that anymore. They wanted a king. The problem is, that's not necessarily a given that the kings are all going to be such wonderful people. You look at the House of Windsor, right? We're talking, for those of you who are not members of the British, of the British, the men of the covenant, the House of Windsor is what we call Queen Elizabeth's family, right? So if you didn't see the King's Speech or any of these movies, I'm a Canuck, so, you know, I have my pedigree is good with the House of Windsor. But, you know, there was a time, I guess, when it mattered. Now it's just like, you know, the figureheads, and it's just like, but they mattered at some time. But then it devolved in a big way over time. And I don't have to point out people, you know, won't mention names, Fergie, but there are names come up that are associated, you know, like with the family. Even, you know, you go to the great prince, heir to the throne, the son of the queen. He's not exactly a well-loved figure. That's the reason he's not probably ever going to be the king. He's probably just going to give it over to his son, William, who's a very popular guy, has a beautiful wife. He'll probably become the new king when Elizabeth can no longer fulfill the job. So you don't have to go very far. So it's not such a difference. It's no guarantee. It's not going to always go from King David to King Solomon. That's an ideal utopian world. Sometimes the son or the grandson of the king, and here's the problem. With a judge, you can opt out. You can say, no. I'm no longer affiliated with that yeshiva. I'm no longer affiliated with that movement anymore. I'm retiring my sombrero, my Borsellino. I'm not going to be part of it because I don't like the path it's taken. What about a king? No way. You can't opt out. He's the king. It's bloodlines, right? For better or worse. So God says, you know what? If you want a king, good. Go gesinnt your hate. Have fun. But tell the people, these are the laws of the king. So now, Samuel's going to tell the people, okay, fine, you want a king? Okay, but here's what the king could do with his powers. Listen to some of the things the king could do. Ready? Verse 10, number Yud. Vayomer Shmuel eis kol divrei Hashem. So Samuel said over all the words of God, El Ha'am, to the people, not just to the elders, apparently, but even to the people who had sent the elders to speak to Samuel personally. Hashoalim eto melech, who had requested a king from him. Vayomer, and he said to them, Zeh. This is going to be the rule, the powers that the king's going to exert over you. Hashem loch alechem, that you will appoint over to you to rule over you. Es b'neichem yikach, he can take your sons, v'sham lo b'merkavto u'farashav, and he can basically just conscript them, boom, he has to pay them, but he can put them in his, to lead his chariots and his cavalry, take him into battle. He can just unilaterally make a decision with a felt pen, and your sons are soldiers. And your beautiful sons, instead of going to law school, to Harvard Medical School, they're going to be running in front of the king's chariot. You like that? King has that power. And he can appoint your kids, if you don't like them being, you know, running in front of the cavalry and chariots, he'll appoint for him captains of thousands, captains of fifties, and you know what they're going to do? He'll make them farmers to take care of the king's lands. They're going to be plowing for him and reaping his harvest, and then they're going to be building weapons of war for him, and they're going to be building implements for his chariot. He's going to be working at Ford in Dearborn, Michigan. You like this? You're going to be on the supply lines building cars if he wants your children. These are your glorious children that you have visions for. He likes your kid. He'll conscript your kid and he'll work for him at cost. And what about your lovely, beautiful little daughters? The Espino say, Chemika. He can also take your girls anytime he wants, your daughters. Ularakachos, Ulatabachos, Ulofos. Not only can he marry them and put them in his harem, but then he can put on little baking outfits and make them into perfumers, cooks, and bakers. You want little Susie wearing a little baking costume? He could take your little precious girl and conscript her too, because he's the king. The es sedos sechem and your fields, the es karmechem and your vineyards, v'zei sechem and your olive groves, hatovim that are good, you know, the ones that you really like, you don't want to give up, yikach, he just takes them. It's called eminent domain. King has ultimate eminent domain. You like it? You like it so far? Then asav avada. And then he'll give your lands to his servants. How are we doing so far, guys? V'sa'arechem v'charmechem ya'asor. And then you have to give tithes. You have to take money from your own, whatever he leaves you, the garbage that he leaves you behind with your fields that you're going to have left, not the best, the choices of your fields and your vineyards. You have to give them from those also tithes. Then asan l'sari savel avadav. And then he's going to present them to his officers and servants. The es avdechem. And he will take your best servants, your strongest workers. The es shivchosechem, and your strongest maidservants. The es bachureichem atovim, and your best young men. The es chamareichem, and your donkeys. Yikach, he'll take it all. Whatever the best of the best always goes to the king, to the melech. The asa limlachto. And he will put them into service to work for him. And again, he will take a tenth of your sheep. You'll be ostensibly slaves to this king that you are requesting. And guess what you're going to do? You're going to cry out! You're going to be like the Egyptians when they got that idiot, wicked Morsi, and they elected the Muslim Brotherhood, and you're going to cry after a year. Remember the Egyptians did this? They said, no, what do? We're such idiots. We put the Muslim Brotherhood. We want to go to the bars. We want to go to the discos in Cairo. And this Muslim Brotherhood whack job Morsi, right, is closing everything down, and we got to become from Islamic guys. We have buyer's regret, right? So you're going to have buyer's regret. Sorry, guys. When you have buyer's regret and you cry out to me, Uza Aktem Bayamu, I know you're going to cry out, God says to Samuel, Milithnei Malchakem, because from before your king, because he's going to take everything that belongs to you and more, Asher Bechartem Lechem, that you chose for yourselves. But God's not going to take your phone call on that day. He is going to be absent. Sorry, you will not be able to get rid of the king. But the people refused. Lishmo v'kol Shmuelti. Heed and listen to the voice of Samuel, his admonition. Vayomru lo! They said, no, no, no! Ki imelech yaleinu, we want that king! Stop. If you look at the verse, Vayomru lo, they said no. Some say they actually interrupted Samuel. In other words, he's telling them, he's going to take your daughter, he's going to get in, right? And they were so invested in the king vision that they basically told him, shut up, stop talking, Shmuel, we want the king. Lo! It's like, it's right there in the middle of the verse, as if to say they interrupted the flow, the narrative being presented to them by Samuel. That's how invested they were in his vision. That we want a king. We want to be just like all the other nations. Ushfatanu, Malkenu, V'yatza Lefanenu. Our king will judge us. He'll go up before us. V'nilchames milchama seinu. He'll fight our battles for us. I mean, God's not doing a good enough job, apparently. V'yishma Shmuel. And so Samuel heard. Oh, boy, did he hear. Remember, God said, listen to the tone of what they're saying to you. Not so much what they say, but how they say it. Eis kol divrayam. He heard all the words of the people. V'yidabrem v'osnei Hashem. And he repeated them, of course, unnecessarily, but God had asked him to, back into the metaphorical ears of God. And now let's close the parakah, the chapter this evening. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Shema b'kolam. So God says, okay, Samuel, listen to their voices. V'himlacht al ha-melech, appoint for them a king. Vayomer Shmuel el kol anshei Yisrael. So Samuel says to all the men of Israel, L'chu ish le'iro. Okay, everybody, go back home. Bye, good night, thanks for coming, we'll get you your king. See ya. And this is an insult to the people, because the people thought, well, we're all the elders. We're the hoi polloi. We're the high and mighty. Maybe one of us will be this melech. And so basically Samuel says, I don't see a king here, guys. Bye, good night. So they all have these delusions of grandeur, right? That maybe they would be the king. So when Samuel says, go back home, he's saying to them, I don't see any kingship here. Sorry, guys, you're not the man. Next week, please God, I will be in Israel.
Nice.
Thank you. And for the next 2 Mondays, we will not be here. And maybe I'll Skype you in from Israel. We'll have a class 7 hours ahead. 2 in the morning in Israel time? I don't think so. But I could dream. So when we return 3 weeks from to this evening, please God willing, we will learn about the new king of Israel. We're going to segue directly. It's marvelous the way it just transitions immediately from Samuel, old Samuel, sons dropping the ball, lack of justice, request for king, and then the king's going to come. We're going to meet the king. And the king, as so often is the case, is going to come from the most unlikely source imaginable. Benjamin, a tribe that was almost entirely eradicated because of a horrific story that I alluded to before called Pelegish Megiddo, when there was a rape and a murder of a young lady. There was this intertribal war and Benjamin was decimated. And yet from the most unlikely source comes the most marvelous individual, who I hate to equate with somebody that Philip and I were talking about earlier, Elisha ben Avuya, but he is tragically almost on that level of tragic character. Someone who did not want to be the king, who was such a gorgeous human being, beautiful man, humble man, and in the end destroys himself. And that is Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, who we're going to meet 3 weeks from this evening. Erev Tov, everyone.